From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. UN member states met Wednesday to commemorate the end of the transatlantic slave trade. The meeting was organized under the theme Women in Slavery, as the UN followed up on the work begun in November of 2006 on the 200th anniversary of the end of the transatlantic slave trade. Daniel Dickinson filed this report from the United Nations.
The theme, Women and Slavery, was chosen by the General Assembly in recognition of the unique struggles enslaved women face. Women are also credited with playing an instrumental role in helping to preserve and pass on the cultural traditions that form such an important part of the African diaspora in the Americas and the Caribbean. Opening the meeting, the President of the General Assembly, Måns Lykketoft, said it was important to reflect on the tragedy of the slave trade this year.
Slavery remains one of the darkest chapters in our past, and on this 70th anniversary year in the United Nations, it's timely that we recommit ourselves to raising public awareness about its legacy of unprecedented horror.
Earlier this year, a permanent memorial to honour the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade was installed on the grounds of UN headquarters in New York. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
The continuing legacy of the transatlantic slave trade and the institution of chattel slavery persists in the discrimination against people of African descent around the world. That reality was at the basis of a special event at UN headquarters Tuesday, headlined Confronting the Silence, Dialogue on Structural Racism Against People of African Descent Worldwide. The meeting was one of a series of events being held to mark the International Decade for People of African Descent. World-renowned entertainer and activist Harry Belafonte delivered the keynote speech.
I first became aware of the importance of this institution because of a deep and abiding friendship that I developed with one of its most important designers, an American by the name of Eleanor Roosevelt. In my earliest years, she took kindly to me and put up with my youthful nonsense, asking her questions that she was patient enough and gracious enough to answer. And she did it by example. And taking on the responsibilities of designing the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, watching her struggle and watching her greet the world at large in her space was a reward for me. It's how I got to know Africans in a way that I would otherwise never have gotten to know them. I knew them through mentors, Paul Robeson, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, Hope Franklin, many great educators here, and people who sought to mentor those of us who are quite young to lead us to a new understanding about Africa and the African diaspora. I also brought other credentials to the table. My mother is a Jamaican. She came to America driven by a sense of adventure and the fact that in America, she thought that there would be opportunity and opportunities that she was not experiencing as a British subject governed by the colonial rules of the day. But she found America not quite what it had been fancied to be. She was undereducated. She came here looking for opportunity. And instead of that, she found belligerence. She found resistance. She discovered racism that took her experience to a new height. But because of her deeper spiritual being, she resisted very strongly the laws of this nation and the plights that not only African Americans were experiencing, but those of us who were descendants of the diaspora. Her counsel, the counsel of Eleanor Roosevelt, the counsel of men like Paul Robeson and Dr. Du Bois did much to shape my life and the choices that I have made to become a part of this great movement to end racism and to end classism. Because of the embrace of my mentors, just Paul Robeson, who very early on found a young group of black actors and artists aspiring to become proficient in our chosen fields. He pointed out that selecting the arts was a wise and a very rewarding thing for those of us who understood the power of the arts and how to apply it. He said, artists are the gatekeepers of truth. We are civilization's radical voice. We are humanity's moral compass. And with that rather hearty launching in describing what we were as young African Americans in the basement of a library in Harlem, I discovered my stimulus for becoming deeply involved in not only using the arts as a tool in which to bring the human family together, to bring clarity and understanding to our common humanity, but to specifically engage in spreading the word of Africa and members of the African diaspora. The songs of the Caribbean, the songs of Africa, the songs of the music that has driven much of American history to the extent that we still struggle as a nation, righteously so, to bring democracy and a deeper humanity to our cause as a nation is still in the mix.
One very important tool in the fight against discrimination, according to Mutumu Rutiiri, the UN's Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism, is information. He says governments around the world need to collect better data to help combat all forms of discrimination, and that more detailed statistics on citizens' ethnicity, economic, and cultural patterns would lead to better awareness and better government policy.
I presented a report that focuses on data and statistics in combating racism and racial discrimination. And that report highlights the importance of collection of data in addressing discrimination, in dealing with problems of structural discrimination in the justice sector, in other forms of governance. And it also recognizes that there might be challenges with regard to collection of data. Some fears that data might be maybe misused has happened in the past. But the report proposes that if collection of data and statistics is located within a human rights framework, then it is possible to mitigate some of the fears and dangers that are associated with collection of racial and ethnic segregated data.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
That was the late American icon Paul Robeson in his rendition of the song about labor organizer Joe Hill. It was 66 years ago this past summer that a performance by Robeson scheduled for Peekskill, New York, was broken up by a racist mob. Robeson, the man who was once the country's best-known actor and singer, and then became one of the foremost victims of the anti-communist fervor that swept the country in the 1940s and 50s, came back the following week and did the performance nevertheless. This weekend, Robeson will make his first appearance in Peekskill since 1949, but he will be doing so posthumously in the body of British actor Tayo Aluko. We spoke with Mr. Aluko via Skype from the UK Thursday. Very interesting choice of subject matter for a one-man play, and quite a big pair of shoes to fill. Call Mr. Robeson.
That's right, a very big pair of shoes. But I've been doing the play for 8 years now, and everywhere I have performed it, people have been most impressed, not just by the play, but by Paul Robeson's story, and it's something that I love doing.
Tell us the format. What do people see when they go there? What's the performance?
Well, it's me on stage as Paul Robeson. With a pianist, a brother called Dennis Nelson from New York. And basically, I tell Paul Robeson's story almost from the start, him telling the audience about how he grew up, you know, and almost right at the start, there's the tragedy of his mother dying when he was 6 years old and being raised with the rest of his siblings, single-handedly by his father, William Drew Robeson, who had actually escaped slavery in North Carolina. And I tell the story of how Robeson got a scholarship to Rutgers College in New Jersey, was the only only black boy in the whole college, but excelled in any case, despite a lot of racism. Studied law. Racism there made him give that up, and he became an actor and a singer. And I think the crucial thing is, or where his life took an interesting twist, is when he came to England, where I live, in 1928 to do Showboat and met Welsh miners who were on strike. And he realized then for the first time that actually white folks could exploit white folks too. And that started his journey in socialism, because he realized then that the struggle of people one against the other is not just a color thing, but a worker against owner struggle. And that set him on a collision course with the authorities. And so I tell stories like this in between and sing songs, sing some of his songs. I intersperse the songs with the story. And as I have demonstrated already, the story is political as well as artistic. And I also deal with his, you know, his personal life, you know, talk about his wife and his son, Paul Jr., and interesting aspects of his life, including, you know, allegations and factual about relationships with other women. He had a struggle with mental health in later life, which is not surprising considering the amount of stress that he was put under by the authorities in the U.S. and even the U.K. Right. So it's described as a roller coaster journey, and it certainly is. His life certainly was one, and I try to reflect that in the play.
Yeah, when you mentioned the Welsh miners, I remember hearing a segment of a radio program that he did when he had his passport taken away from him and he couldn't travel out of the United States. He did a radio program with a chorus of Welsh miners on the other end of the phone, I guess, or whatever, where they produced together a radio program from across.
That's right. It wasn't actually a radio program. It was a live concert,
right
down the telephone. And I that was, that particular story was, it was in an earlier version of my play, but it didn't survive subsequent drafts. But it's interesting that, you know, this is a man who was, most people know of as an entertainer, a singer, as an actor. But why did he have his passport cancelled by his government? Now, a lot of people don't know about that. But basically, it was because he was saying the things that, you know, like Muhammad Ali would say in the 1960s, I ain't going to fight no Viet Cong because they didn't call me N-word.
Right.
And so he Paul Robeson was saying things like that in the 1940s, and it got to a stage where, he made this speech in Paris saying more or less that. And by the time he got back to the States in August 1949 and was due to sing in Peekskill, that speech had been distorted in the press. And from being the most popular and most successful entertainer of his age, black or white, all of a sudden he became public enemy number one. Mm. With the result that when he got to Peekskill to do this concert, there was a huge riot and it had to be cancelled. But he resolved to go back the following week and the concert went ahead.
Yeah, at that time, at the second concert, apparently the state police actually flushed out a little sniper's nest that was waiting to assassinate him.
That's right. And as I demonstrate in the play, when I'm doing that Peekskill scene, there was an effigy of Paul hanging from a tree. So these people were out to kill him. And they were out to kill other black people, and in fact, Jews. So it seems that Paul Robeson's visit to Peekskill in August, September 1949 exposed probably the worst part of the United States at that time. Yeah. And it's a history which... a lot of people don't know about. It's uncomfortable to recover, to unearth, but I think it is hopefully a measure of, I say hopefully, use that word advisedly, of how far the U.S. has traveled since that time.
And we're going to find out Saturday, the 7th, you're performing the play in Peekskill at the Paramount.
That's right, yes. It's going to be quite, some people might refer to it as a homecoming, taking Paul Robeson back to the belly of the beast.
Indeed. Maybe you could take us through a very brief tour of his life. One thing many people don't know here anymore, although they knew it before they knew that he was quote-unquote a commie at the height of the Cold War, was that he was... as close to a Renaissance man as the United States has ever produced, as an academic, as a legal scholar, as an athlete, and as an artist.
Oh, yes. I go back to when he was at Rutgers College, which is now a big university, but at that time it was just a prestigious, practically all-white college. And he became a Phi Beta Kappa scholar there. He was their star debater. He gave the valedictory speech when he was leaving. He was an All-American footballer there in 1917 and 18. Although his name was removed from the record in the 1940s, I think it's now been reinstated. He studied law at Columbia University. He qualified, but... stopped practicing even before he, as a trainee. One of the other things was, even in Rutgers, he'd started doing his acting and singing. He played Othello first in Rutgers, but famously played it all over the United States in the 40s. He played it in the UK in the 30s, and then in 1960. I was a film actor. He was a linguist. He spoke. It's difficult. Nobody really knows how many languages he spoke fluently, but it could have been up to 25.
Yes, many.
So if that was his only achievement, that would make him a genius. But he was this great orator and political activist. He's a sportsman in many sports. And traveled the world as a singer, actor, and activist. So it's I mean, I discovered the story almost by accident because I was singing somewhere and somebody said, "You remind me of Paul Robeson." And then I stumbled on his biography a few months after that and read this book, and it was, it just blew my mind. And the fact that, you know, it seemed as though my life before that had been preparing me to tell his story because I was a singer as an amateur, you know, I was working as an architect up until then.
Right.
But then this story presents itself to me, and without having been a professional writer or actor, I thought this is a story that really needs to be told. Because for me, this man represents the best of humanity. And it's a tragedy that he was so hounded because he was calling for peace among nations, including the Soviet Union. And how ironic is it that today, you know, in 2015, we are back to seeing the Soviet Union or Russia with so much suspicion. You know, nobody's saying that the leader of the Soviet Union is a saint. But, you know, the Soviet Union, again, is seen as with many other people around the world, as enemies to the United States. Muslims are an enemy to the United States, it is said. Communists still exist and are an enemy to the state. You know, so Paul Robeson was, I suggest, asking people in his time to look at other human beings with humanity, as he asked, and, you know, them to look at African Americans and Africans with humanity. And, you know, we are all one people, and that was his message. But that message was unwelcome by the authorities, and, you know, he was hounded for that. And, you know, I think it's a tragedy, but also a great inspiration in the fact that he decided to continue preaching his message of peace and love and deciding to use his art for that purpose.
The many generations subsequent who looked to him as their inspiration. Harry Belafonte, for example, was at the United Nations earlier this week, and he cites Paul Robeson as one of his main, you know, guiding lights in his, you know, in his career in terms of his political life.
Indeed, and what a you know, I mean, if Harry Belafonte should cite Paul Robeson as a good person, then, you know, that's good enough for me, because Harry himself is a towering figure in today's world. You know, not revered as much as he ought to be, but to think that he was there with Dr. King, and is still there today fighting for civil rights, not just in the United States, but around the world, you know, and he always mentioned Paul Robeson as his inspiration. You know, that's a hell of a legacy.
Mm. It's interesting, too. Robeson, aside from his politics as expressed and his activities and his, you know, he stood right in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee and you know, read them the Riot Act. Aside from his own actions, his very being was a contradiction to the racist imagery that existed in the United States. The big, scary black man, the brute, the super masculine. He was a towering figure physically. He had a baritone voice, but he had projected the gentlest personality. He spoke of peace and love. And he was also one of the most understanding people. They set Jackie Robinson against him at the time, you know, trying to create some sort of tension between the two. And Paul instead was very understanding of Jackie Robinson's predicament.
That's right. And he refused to criticize Jackie Robinson. And yes, you know, Jackie Robinson would come to regret it. And I if I have my facts right, would eventually write to Paul Robeson apologizing for criticizing him in public. But Paul Robeson refused the invitation to criticize Jackie Robinson because he was wiser than everybody else, knowing exactly what was being attempted to create conflict between black people. Yeah, and you know, I've performed the play in the UK for many years, and be it Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, Wales, North England, South England, East, West, I always meet people who say with great pleasure and pride that, you know, Paul Robeson was my father's favorite. My grandfather took me to see Paul Robeson, and I loved his voice even as a child. I used to listen to him, you know, after I should have been in bed, because that voice was something. So this is a man who just generated love everywhere. Literally, he was known about, he was heard. And yes, it's, but, you know, the establishment, I argue, because of what he represented, just felt that they had to demonize him, and they succeeded, you know.
Right.
It's, you know, the propaganda of the time worked, and to this day it still works, because people still, you know, I often hear people say, oh, Paul Robeson, he was a commie, wasn't he?
Right.
As though, you know, that sort of negates everything else that he achieved.
And in fact, his son said he wasn't. You know, he was a socialist, but he said my father was an independent person. He wasn't affiliated with any party.
That's right. That's right. He did campaign for the Progressive Party in the 1940s. That's like campaigning for the Socialist Party now, if one still exists in the United States.
Or the Greens.
But,
yeah.
You know, he knew that it was not a big party. They didn't have much much chance, and they were, you know, severely beaten in that election. But that was a party that he felt represented the best chance of a good future for all working Americans, regardless of their race.
Yeah, Henry Wallace's campaign rested on making peace with the Soviet Union and in doing away with Jim Crow in the United States. Hard to argue with that as a platform.
Hard to argue with that.
But demonized,
you know,
at the time.
I mean, I believe that in modern times in the United States, the only person that has run for president that, you know, with that kind of ticket, knowing that it was almost hopeless, was it Cynthia McKinney? Is that
the
right
correct
name?
Yep, that's her. Yep,
that's right. And she stood for the Green Party. But how many people know or talk about her today? But,
right,
you know, she had that principle, and I presume she knew about Paul Robeson herself.
Oh, yes, she does. I'm certain she does.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump off Paul's life for a moment and ask about yours. You know, I see from the tour, you know, the tour history, that you've been not just to the four corners of the UK, but to your native Nigeria, you know, in terms of where you were born, and all the way to New Zealand on the other side of the world. Now, as an architect going to all of these different theaters, do you ever look at the room critically and wonder if, gee, couldn't they have put the roof in a different way or something else to help the acoustics?
No, I don't. I haven't done that. One iconic building that I haven't been to, that I plan to go to perform called Mr. Robeson on my 60th birthday, is the Sydney Opera House. So we'll see if that happens, and I'm sure it's a fitting venue for a celebration of Robeson, which actually, incidentally, I've chosen as a target because he sang there in 1960 as it was being built. He was on tour in Australia and New Zealand, and he went to the Sydney Opera House to sing to the workers on the building site.
Wow.
So he was the first person to sing at the Sydney Opera House to the workers.
Before there even was a Sydney Opera House. Wow.
Exactly, exactly.
So you'll be on this side of the pond for the month of November. You'll be in Peekskill on the 7th, and then in Hackettstown, New Jersey, from the 12th to the 15th of November, and then out to Nova Scotia, Halifax, the 19th to 21st.
That's right, yes. So it's a little three-week tour, and then back to the UK.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.